This is an interview with Richard Nesson for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is June 4th, 2012. We're talking at the Luness offices in New York City. Mr. Nesson, thanks very much for talking to me today.
You're welcome.
First of all, just to start off, where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Cambridge, Mass. And grew up, first 8 years of my life, I lived in a section of Boston called Brighton, Mass. And then we moved to Newton, Mass, where I continued to mature and went to Newton High School, graduating in 1960.
While you were in high school, did you already know that you wanted to be a lawyer when you grew up?
Not at all, although my dad was a lawyer. He was a general practitioner, so I certainly was, I was very close to my parents and obviously was very influenced in that direction.
What did you think you were going to do, or did you have a clue?
I had no idea. My father was a general practitioner. In those days, having lived through the Depression, would take whatever business came in the door. I think never started out any year really knowing where his revenue was going to come from. So it was that kind of practice of law. I think was on its way out. It was not anything that I really aspired to at that time. But I really had no idea what I would do as a lawyer. Mm-hmm.
And you went to Harvard as an undergraduate?
Right. I went to Harvard College and then went on immediately after I graduated to the University of Michigan Law School.
What was your major as an undergraduate?
I majored in government.
Okay. And when did you decide to go to law school?
Actually, I was thinking about it, while I was in college and pretty much made the determination in my senior year that that's probably, what I would be doing.
So you applied to law school, you were a senior, and then started the next year, or was there a period
correct.
In between?
Yeah, exactly. That's what one did in those days. Mm-hmm. I think we were already very involved as a country in the war in Vietnam. I'm not sure at that point whether getting drafted would have been an issue at that particular time. It did become one later on.
What year did you start law school?
I started in 1964.
Okay, and you went to the University of Michigan, right?
Right.
And any particular reason Michigan, or you just applied to a lot of places, got in there, was the best option?
Pretty much it.
Yeah, so it goes. Yeah. Did you expect did you have a focus on business law or securities law or anything like that?
No, not at all. I took a corporations course, I don't believe I took a course in securities. I was interested, I think, while I was there in taxation courses. Mm-hmm. And I seemed to do well in them. So that was really, when I got out of law school, that was a focus of mine at that time.
What was your first job after law school?
Well, before I got a job, I went into the service. I was very fortunate that I was able to avoid the draft, very fortunate to get into a unit of the Army Reserve. So I went in right after I took the bar exam in July of 1967. I went into the reserves, went to basic training and so forth, which was a four-month commitment, and got out in November of 1967 without having made any plans beyond that. So I started roaming around the city of Boston trying to get interviews with law firms that had already made hiring decisions for that year. So I did that for about 3 or 4 months and then decided maybe I better look at Washington as, mm-hmm. as a place to go with the idea that I would come back to Boston at some point.
Yeah. And where did you end up in Washington?
I ended up at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Actually, it was the Federal Housing Administration. I'm not even sure at that point that it was part of HUD, but that's where I started. And I started in February of 1968. Mm-hmm. At the FHA.
What sorts of issues were you working on there?
I don't know whether I don't know whether I would even call them issues. I was in an office, it was a general counsel's office with about four or five other lawyers. And basically what we did is, on an occasional basis, review documentation relating to the transfer of FHA guaranteed properties from one owner to another. So there wasn't a lot of work to do. When you did get a file, essentially all you had to do was just make sure that the forms were correctly filled out. We all spent a lot of time doing other things. I recall that doing crossword puzzles was a major activity. And I remember it was, you know, one could get annoyed when a piece of work actually came in to disturb your train of thought on crossword puzzles. Yeah. So I needed to get out of there.
Right. Okay. I was going to ask you what motivated you to leave that cushy position. But in any case, you ended up at the SEC within a couple of years, right?
Right. During the time that I was at the FHA, I started in a tax program, master's in tax program at Georgetown, and did take a securities course. So I did enjoy that. I was aware that the SEC was a premier government agency with a great reputation, and applied to the SEC and was lucky enough to get in there. I think I started in probably June of 1969, mm-hmm. something like that.
Was there any sort of training given to you, or were you just thrown on the job?
No training that I can recall. I was placed in the Division of Corporation Finance in a unit, in an enforcement unit called Investigations and Administrative Proceedings, mm-hmm. and basically learned from the more senior lawyers in that group as to what it was I was supposed to be doing.
And you said you had done a master's in tax preparation, right?
Right. I never completed it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but you started out. But at least you had some background on financial issues when you got
sort
in.
Of.
Yeah. Okay. How would you describe the level of, I guess, knowledge of these different specific tax and other issues that and regular or financial issues among the Division of Corporation Finance at this time?
Well, there were certainly people, principally in the reviewing branches, that mm-hmm. that had a very good understanding of financial issues and disclosure issues, and you know, in the unit that I was in, we would get our cases referred to us by people in the reviewing branches. So gradually over time, I became a little bit more familiar with financial issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and were you involved in enforcement actions at this time?
I was, no biggies. There were several people in the unit that worked on national student marketing. I just had a tangential involvement. That was probably the biggest case that came up during the time that I was in that unit. The fellow who really led the charge on that was a lawyer by the name of Dave Belkin. And Dave, when the Division of Enforcement was created, I think in 1972, Dave in that case went down to enforcement, and that's where the case eventually was resolved.
Can you give me a little bit of background on that case? What was involved there?
It was basically financial fraud. Accounting for very iffy transactions, mm-hmm. and of course that was a case ultimately that involved sanctions against the accounting firm, individuals in the accounting firm, as well as an attorney.
I understand that there was a huge pretrial discovery program in that case that many, many witnesses provided testimony. Were you involved in that at all?
Or just tangentially. I think much of that occurred down in the Division of Enforcement.
Okay. Yeah. So in 1972, there was an organizational restructuring within the SEC, and
right.
A lot of these enforcement branches got consolidated into one division of enforcement.
Right.
How did that look from your perspective?
From my perspective, that was fine because I didn't really want to do that any longer at that time. Right. And I was lucky enough to be one of the three lawyers from that branch, from the investigations branch in Corp Fin, that was retained in Corp Fin, and got to work on some public proceedings at that point. I'm not sure that we, that we had a name for the group. I think eventually it became the Office of Disclosure Policy under Dick Rowe.
Right. From your perspective, was this a logical restructuring to have all the enforcement branches people under one branch?
I think it made sense from the point of view of the commission. I'm not sure all of the people in Corp Fin felt that way. We were a small branch. We were available to the reviewing branches. There may have been some concern by the reviewing branches that maybe the function were down in an enforcement division, that maybe their concerns wouldn't be addressed as quickly. But I don't know.
Yeah. But you said that you were happy that you stayed within Corp Fin at the time.
Right, I was. I really enjoyed working for Alan Levinson, who was the division director at that point.
Did he hire you?
No, Alan did not hire me. I was hired, I guess the division director then was Charlie Shreve.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who was frankly responsible for hiring me. It may have been the head of the branch that I refer to as a fellow by the name of Ralph Tracy. Mm-hmm. Ralph was replaced by Dick Rowe when Dick came back from California along with Alan Levinson, early in the 70s.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about Alan Levinson.
I really liked Alan quite a bit. He was really a great guy. He was an incredibly smart guy, and I think very generous with his time. He was somebody that that did enjoy spending time with junior attorneys and trying to show them the right way to do things. He was a terrific guy and somebody that he passed away a few years ago, and I know a lot of people really miss Alan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then in 1975, Richard Rowe took over as director of
Right.
Fin, right? How did their personalities compare?
Well, Alan certainly was more outgoing. I think Dick was probably more shy than Alan had been. But Dick was very effective, and he was really, when Alan was the division director, I think he relied on Dick to a very large degree.
Mm-hmm.
Dick was a very smart guy, mm-hmm. and really understood the law.
Okay, so after the restructuring, you stayed in Corp Fin. What sorts of issues were you working on at that time?
Well, I was doing this work for Dick. We did a public investigation of the hot issue securities markets.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. I don't know that we really ended up at the end of the day. I don't know that the commission really ended up with anything too terribly significant. We did propose and I think have the commission adopt changes to the disclosure. To the prospectus disclosure, requiring kind of more upfront disclosure of risks. And I think there was some effort to get the SROs to do something in the area of due diligence and free riding and so forth. I do recall one hearing that we had during that period of time when we had an underwriter from a company that I think was called Metropolitan Quarterback, that was one of these fast food franchises, and they made hamburgers. And I remember asking the underwriter's representative, "Well, what did you do by way of due diligence?" And he said, "Well, basically, the only thing I did was I ate one of their hamburgers without ill effect." So clearly, there was a need for something further in the due diligence area.
Mm-hmm. Were you also working on the issue of corporate earnings projections?
I did. That was another public proceeding that we had where, excuse me, we ended up proposing some fairly formal requirements, I think not requiring, but giving companies an opportunity to disclose projections of earnings and so forth, but requiring that if they did that, then they had to follow up periodically with modifications in their projections, and there were, you know, there was quite a bit of additional conditions that I think ultimately led the commission not to adopt those recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Were you also involved in the SEC's voluntary disclosure program?
Just barely. I think at that point I was no longer doing the public proceedings, and I did go on in CorpFin to a reviewing branch, and then subsequently I worked for an assistant director. And I think I did get involved because there were certain companies that we had responsibility for reviewing who were coming into the Division of Enforcement to do a mea culpa. And I recall one instance, and I think the company was called Castle and Cook, and they were involved in importing bananas. And I remember them coming in and saying that they, like other importers, had paid off the dock hands in a particular foreign country. And they admitted that they disclosed it on their books as cost of first fruit, or first cost of fruit, something like that. And I remember that example and other similar examples that were brought to Alan Levinson's attention caused him to conclude and finally get the commission to conclude that although the amounts were not material in economic terms, that falsification of books and records in that fashion in and of itself was material and required some action by the commission.
So that was material and required some action. But then I understand, just to use a specific example of, you know, money paid to dock workers, for instance, to unload goods. I think in the final legislation on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, something like that would be considered a facilitating payment, right?
Right.
And would not be specifically banned by the act.
Right.
Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
But the falsification of books and records continue to be a problem, you know, continue to be a violation under the act.
So there was a lot of different discussion within the commission at this time about what it should be legitimate, what is illegitimate,
right,
what is material, what is not material.
Right, and then of course what the commission may have proposed didn't necessarily make it through the legislative process.
No, that's true. No. And you also worked on the Robert Vesco case too, right?
You know, I will refer to an interview that was done, I'm not sure about you, with Dick Rowe, which is in the museum, and Dick refers to this as well. What Dick said is that he was summoned to Stanley's office, Stanley Sporkin's office. There was a deposition to be taken of Robert Vesco concerning international controls, and I guess I was summoned by Dick because I remember being there as well. And Robert Vesco was, first of all, he looked like a riverboat gambler. It's probably a look that was intentional. Had a mustache, he had slick back hair. He was, during the course of this deposition, certainly the most arrogant and the most disdainful of the staff of any witness I've ever seen at the commission. And he was so disdainful that at one point he took his shoes off and he stuck his stocking feet up on a chair, which happened to be very close to where I was sitting. And I can tell you that that was not a pleasant experience for me. The other thing I remember, and Dick refers to this in his interview as well, is that we reached a point where we were going to go off the record and perhaps break for lunch or something like that. And during, before we broke, but we were off the record, Robert Vesco said to Stanley, I really like your house. And Stanley said, what? He said, yeah, I have a picture of your house in Maryland. And Stanley said, well, what is that all about? And Vesco said, well, I understand that you've had Interpol following me all over Europe and taking pictures of me, so I decided to do the same with you. And we then broke for lunch. We went back into Stanley's office, where Stanley went berserk and was talking about how this guy was taking pictures of my wife, my children, and clearly Robert Vesco made an enemy for life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, now I understand that for a time you worked in the Office of Disclosure Policy, right?
Right.
Uh-huh. What did that office do?
Well, that office, I believe that the only thing that we worked on while I was there was the corporate governance project, which really took off when Harold Williams joined the commission as chairman. It was something of great interest to him. And ultimately, we had a series of hearings around the country, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Washington, starting off, I recall, with Evelyn Y. Davis, who didn't need a microphone to make her views heard. But anyway, we started with a set of hearings, went out for comments on, you know, a large number of conceptual issues. Spent a lot of time winnowing down the comments into something that, you know, that could be read, and then proceeded with some proposals for the commission to consider.
So I understand that at one point you were tasked with investigating Stanley's portrait.
Right. That was an interesting event. It was probably 1976 or 1977, and the commission had received a complaint, I believe, from Adnan Khashoggi, who was associated with some registration statements that were being looked at by the Division of Enforcement. And Mr. Khashoggi apparently accused Stanley Sporkin in a letter to the commission of some kind of impropriety, I can't remember what, because Stanley was Division of Enforcement Director, and the commission was obligated to investigate the allegations that were made by Mr. Khashoggi. It couldn't be done by the Division of Enforcement. Corp Finn got it. Dick Rowe assigned Barbara Leventhal, now Barbara Lucas, and myself to investigate these allegations. We were both aware of Mr. Khashoggi's reputation, and of course, we're very fond and knew Stanley very well. And I must say that our investigation of Stanley, which did include a very brief interview with him, probably didn't take very long.
Mm-hmm. So these were basically spurious charges from your
right.
perspective.
Correct.
So.
Correct.
Okay, that's an interesting side note on the history of this period. Yep. So you also served on the Task Force on Corporate Accountability.
Right. I served with Barbara and with several others, a few others in the division, Mike Stackius, Jennifer Sullivan, and it was a public proceeding that was given impetus by Harold Williams, who was the chairman at that time. We went out for public comment. We We did a number of hearings, public hearings around the country. Mm-hmm. We interviewed probably between 50 and 100 people.
And what was your specific role on the task force?
Basically, I was, Barbara was head of it, I was the deputy. Uh-huh. And at that point, we were basically tasked with, getting all of these comments together in some form that the commission could read and understand, and ultimately we came up with a series of proposals for the commission to consider. There were two phases to the investigation. The first phase involved proposals relating, strictly speaking, to disclosure in proxy statements, disclosure relating to the independence of directors, the existence and composition of the nominating audit and compensation committees of the board, things of that nature.
Okay. Were any of these new rules actually implemented? Which ones were?
We went to the commission initially. We were quite ambitious. And the staff came up with a definition of independence, which the commission, I don't believe, went out with. I believe it was shot down at the commission.
Do you remember what the elements of that definition were, in general terms?
I think the basic elements had to do with the relationship of the director to the issuer, and we may have. I believe we tried to define the term independence in terms of the absence of those relationships. As I say, I believe it was shot down by the commission, principally because there was concern that if you weren't deemed to be an independent director, there might be an aspersion cast that you weren't capable of independent judgment. So. As I say, I believe it was shot down by the commission, and I think the compromise was to go out with a proposal which probably had the same definition, but the term was non-affiliated director. And that, I believe, did go out for comment. There were comments on both sides of the issue, and ultimately the commission did not decide to adopt that proposal. I think what we ended up with was disclosure about the existence and the composition of members of the three key committees, as well as the board, but without any attempt to define what that characterization was.
Okay. Now, was your service on this task force, was that the last major, accomplishment that you had before you left the SEC, or did you
work on something else after that? Well, there was one other phase of that whole project, which involved changes to the proxy card itself. And we did accomplish something. It's probably more significant these days than it was at the time, but we did, the commission did adopt a proposal that gave shareholders the opportunity to vote not only for, but against individual directors. As you may recall, prior to that time, the only choice you had as a shareholder was to vote in favor of the slate that had been put up by management. Mm-hmm. And there was no other choice. If you didn't want to do that, you could throw your proxy card away.
Yeah, your name.
And then similarly, we gave shareholders the opportunity to abstain from voting on certain shareholder proposals. I'm sorry, not shareholder proposals, but proposals made by management.
So at that point in your career, you eventually left the SEC. Why did you decide to go somewhere else?
Well, I had been at the commission for a number of years and had been through a couple of phases of the corporate governance project. There was one further phase which involved writing a report to Congress, and I figured that was going to take some period of time. And if there was an opportunity for me outside of the commission, that was probably a good time for me to look at it.
Right.
So I did have an opportunity to join the staff of the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board as Deputy General Counsel, and I started there immediately after leaving the commission in 1979.
Did you know much about municipal securities at the time?
Not at all. No.
Okay. Yeah. What was the status of the MSRB at that point? Can you tell me a little bit about the organization?
Sure. It had started, I believe, in 1975 or 1976. I know that the commission, rather that the board and the staff, had worked very hard to put together a set of rules that the board was expected to adopt for the municipal securities dealers and brokers. So that part of the mission really had been accomplished. I think while I was there, we were working on enhancing some of those rules, putting into effect an arbitration process for people that that had problems with their municipal securities dealer. So it was basically a period of time of rule enhancement. When I eventually became general counsel, I think in 1980, spent a lot of time dealing with the board. For example, it was important to the organization that minutes of board meetings, and we met, I think every other month, the board met every other month, but minutes were quite voluminous, and I needed to make sure that the comments of every one of the 15 board members were reflected in the minutes. So minutes, could take many days to prepare the minutes after a board meeting. Mm-hmm. It was a very small staff, and I think worked very effectively.
How would you describe the relationship between the board members and the staff?
It was very close.
Yeah.
Very.
Obviously, a small organization. You probably knew each other.
Knew each other. We tended in those days. The board tended to hold its meetings outside of Washington. Various resorts around the country, and it was a very close relationship. You ended up having dinner with board members quite often when we were out of Washington, playing tennis with them, playing golf with them, and mm-hmm. so forth. So wow. The relationship was very close.
Yes, I can imagine. Yeah. And of course, this period followed a rather difficult period, I guess, in the history of municipal securities. Of course, you had the New York City crisis, Penn
right.
Central. Were these things still resonating at the time when you joined, or was it starting to fade?
The major crisis then involved what were called whoops bonds, the Washington public power bonds. And
the early 1980s, right?
Yeah, I believe there was a fault there. And that's kind of around the time that I joined the organization. There was some discussion about that, but generally speaking, I think the concern about the Memphis bond daddies, which had given rise to the creation of the MSRB, I think was basically behind the organization at that point.
Okay. Yeah. So how did you move from the MSRB to the DTC?
DTC, Depository Trust Company, at that point was beginning to make eligible for book entry delivery services municipal bonds, at that time mainly bearer bonds. And so the board, the management of DTC was going around and introducing itself to the various organizations that were involved with municipal bonds, including the MSRB. And we were at dinner one night with folks from DTC, and I happened to be sitting next to a fellow by the name of Jim Riley, who was head of planning. At that point, my wife had taken a job with Citibank, so she was in New York. I was in Washington with the kids, and I was looking for a job in Washington, in New York. And I got to talking with Jim Riley, and Jim said, we may have a position on our legal staff for somebody with some knowledge of municipal security. So Anyway, that's how I became interested in DTC. Came up, interviewed with Bill Dancer, who was the chairman at that time, and, mm-hmm. and got the job.
Who was the general counsel at the time?
Ned McGuire.
Okay. Yeah. So what was the interest for DTC in processing municipal securities businesses?
Well, it was the next it was the next obvious product for DTC to take mm-hmm. on, and there was I think some substantial interest on the part of the industry. To have DTC make those securities eligible, custody them. I mean, custody of bearer bonds was an enormously expensive issue for the banks in particular. So there was an interest in DTC doing it, and fortunately TEFRA came along, required essentially all new issues of municipal bonds. To be in registered form, mm-hmm. and that became effective, I think, in 1973.
Yep.
I'm sorry, 1983.
83. Yeah. Okay. What were the major obstacles, at least from a legal perspective, for DTC to process these securities or to hold these securities?
Well, I think the major obstacle probably was with respect to state law, and some states, did not recognize the concept of book entry delivery mm-hmm. of securities. But there was significant work that had been undertaken on behalf of DTC earlier, and that continued, and I think eventually, with the help of some of the other regional depositories, that problem was successfully addressed.
So different representatives from DTC and maybe in some cases these regional security depositories were going around and meeting with the state officials,
exactly.
explaining the situation, trying to get them to pass legislation.
Exactly.
Did you do some of that, or was that mostly accomplished by the
Congress? I think I did do some of that, probably not in person. I do recall having correspondence with folks in California. The California insurance. It was basically the insurance laws that were the problem in these states. And insurance commissions wanted to make sure that the securities were within the state, located within the state. When the Pacific Depository decided to give up the business and we absorbed them, DTC absorbed them, we needed to deal with that issue in California. I do recall that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about the relations with labor and unions at DTC? I understand that there were a few issues in the middle of the 80s.
Yeah, there were a few issues. For a long period of time, DTC's relationship with its union members was determined by the New York Stock Exchange, which was kind of a hangover from an earlier period when the predecessor to DTC was actually part of the New York Stock Exchange. I think it was called CCS. Mm-hmm. In any event, I believe it was early in the 1980s that DTC decided to have an independent relationship with its union members. And the negotiations with the union ultimately, to the surprise of management, fell apart at the last minute. Frankly, I think the management of the union was surprised by that as well. Mm-hmm. In any event, they took a strike vote and they went on strike. This was probably 1984. There was, on the part of DTC management, there was a firm determination that we had to continue to process as we had before. We had made contingency plans to bring in quote volunteers from our members to help. All of us had been cross-trained. I ended up, although I was a lawyer, I ended up in the reconciliation department trying to deal with inquiries from participants asking why they hadn't gotten credit for securities that they were sure they had deposited with us, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And that went on, I think, for a couple, 3 weeks before enough union members crossed the picket line that the union basically decided to accept the proposal that had previously been made by management.
Right.
And that was the last time that I, there were negotiations with the union from time to time, nothing untoward happened.
Okay. But by the end of the 1980s and early 1990s, there had begun to be a lot of talk about shortening the settlement cycle, shortening the settlement period, moving from a five-day period to a three-day period. Did that pose legal challenges, or was that mostly a technological thing? Was it something you worked on?
I mean, it was basically a technological issue. Mm-hmm. And I know that that our chairman, Bill Dentzer, disagreed with many people in the industry and with staff at the SEC in thinking that the industry really wasn't ready for to move from T plus 5 to T plus 3, and took a very strong position on behalf of DTC that move should be delayed.
Right. Uh-huh. And then, of course, in the early 1990s, that was eventually shortened somewhat under Bill Dentzer's successor. Right.
Right. It was. Yeah. There was a long run up to the conversion to T plus 3 mm-hmm. that began actually while Bill Dentzer was still chairman, but it continued for a period of time thereafter.
Right.
And despite the fact that DTC took the position that it did early on. Opposing T plus 3 conversion, we no doubt did the bulk of the work necessary for the industry to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think it's possible one day that it'll actually be shortened to either same day settlement or at least T plus 1 or?
Yeah, I think it's certainly the technology at some future time to permit it. Right.
Okay.
I think the issue always is. Making sure that there's a fail-safe there, that there's an opportunity, there's some period of time given so that trades can be reversed if there's a good reason to do that.
Right. Okay. Let's see. In the early 1990s, DTC also began to process commercial paper in book entry form. Was that, were there legal challenges to that, or was that also just a technological thing?
There were legal challenges. For the first time, we were subject in connection with the whole same day fund settlement project, which preceded commercial paper. We were faced with supervision, heavy supervision by the New York Fed. Obviously, we had to have a bank account there, and there was I would say the issues were more on the regulatory side than the legal side. When we moved to commercial paper, I think the biggest difficulty that we had. I don't know whether you'd call it legal or not, but we needed to mirror the processing that had been going on in the physical world. In particular, paying agents at the time had until 3 o'clock in the afternoon to reverse maturities that day, reverse new issuances that day, in the event that the issuer for which they were agent, had unforeseen difficulties, and we had to come up with a procedure to mirror that in the book entry world, and ultimately there was a lot of conversation about that, and a lot of input from the Fed and from the industry, and ultimately that's what we did. We had to come up with a kind of a jerry-rig system that preserved that opportunity for agents. To refuse new maturities, new issues and maturities.
Okay. Yep. Now I'd like to ask you a little bit about the relationship between DTC and the regional depositories.
Okay.
Yeah.
That goes back to my early days at DTC. One of the first things that Bill Dentzer had me do was to review a draft of a memorandum that he was prepared to send to the SEC about interdepository interface fees. And Bill had a very, very strong view that the DTC participants ought not to be able to take advantage of their participation in other depositories if that resulted in additional cost to DTC from processing their transactions. For example, a participant might have a participant account at Midwest Securities Depository and one at DTC. They could deposit their securities at MSTC and do a book entry delivery to their account at DTC and then use that credit, that securities credit, to do a delivery off. In the meantime, the securities were at in Chicago. The feeling at DTC was they were not as efficient as we were. They wouldn't inform us as quickly as we inform participants normally about actions involving those securities, wouldn't pay us the interest or dividends as quickly as we paid our participants. So there were all these issues involving additional cost and lack of efficiency, which Bill felt should be reflected in a surcharge to our participants, those of them who used the interface. Mm-hmm. And that was a very strong view. I read this memorandum that he had written, and I went into his office and I said, you know, this sounds like so many angels dancing on the head of a pin. Well, Bill was a very gentle guy, and so, but I do remember he did chastise me in a very gentle manner, and I never made that mistake again. But it was it continued to be an issue that he pressed from time to time. We continued to make filings with the SEC. They continued not to act on them over, you know, a long period of time. So that was that, you know, that was one continuing issue with the other depositories. Ultimately, they all went out of business.
Right.
The industry just simply couldn't afford the infrastructure, the bricks and mortar,
Now, when you say go out of business, do you mean that they just were eventually acquired by DTC? Because
correct.
Of course that's what did happen. But
right.
Was it always just a matter of the regional depositories coming and saying, well, look, we're having trouble. Can you guys take us over?
That was the case in every case.
Was it? Okay.
Absolutely.
So DTC, it wasn't like a hostile takeover.
No, no, never.
Cribs.
No.
All right.
That being the case, it was a fairly, although there were operational issues that we had to go through, but it was a fairly easy matter to get the SEC to approve those arrangements.
Was DTC ever worried about appearing as though it wanted to have a monopoly? Was that a concern? Were they worried about increased scrutiny, possible nationalization?
Not at that time.
Not at that time.
I mean, there may have been people who were concerned about it, but I think we were happy that we didn't have to deal with the others.
Right. Understood. Okay, I'd like to ask you about the merger of NSCC and DTC in 1999. Obviously, a very big event. What led to that merger?
Well, I think it was, I think the industry basically, again, this is the story from, from the 80s into the 90s. They were not interested in, continuing to foot the cost. Principally in the technology area of supporting both DTC and NSCC. NSCC's technology was run by SIAC, and I think the feeling was that if we could put DTC's technology together with NSCC, there could be a considerable cost savings. Also, DTC and NSCC weren't always on the same page. We had different boards of directors. We certainly had different managements. We had different ambitions, I suppose.
My understanding is that you were located in the same building, right?
We were.
Okay, but there was very little communication between the four.
Very little communication between the two. Obviously, there was some communication transactions that you know that were being processed by NSCC. The security side was being settled by DTC, so there was communication, you know, in those areas. But in terms of outreach, I think we did run into some competitive issues.
Yeah. Well, did staff ever move back and forth between the two agencies?
No.
Did people get hired by one or the other, or would that have been treason?
Might have been considered treason by some, but no, that I don't recall any instance of that happening.
Okay. Now, from a legal perspective, what were the main challenges of the merger? Obviously, there were lots of administrative personnel.
Yeah, I think that there were some governance issues. There were, you know, what do we do? NSCC is owned by the New York Stock Exchange, and the NESD. I'm not quite sure when the NESD took over Amex, but in any event, those were the two owners of NSCC. DTC was owned by probably 60% of its stock was owned by participants, and the other 40% was owned by the New York Stock Exchange, the NESD, and / Amex. And so we had to figure out a way to deal with those ownership issues. Ultimately, the way that was worked out was participants of DTC got one share of DTCC for each share of DTC, and the two owners of NSCC got preferred stock, which gave them the right to put one person on DTCC's board. And there were some, there were a couple of other conditions that we put in the shareholders agreement that were important to the New York and NESD, but ultimately didn't amount to anything.
Was the SEC supportive of the decision to merge?
They were. Yeah, I think they understood the reasons for doing it. I don't recall there being major regulatory issues. I don't recall that there was anything significant in the way of public comment when we went out with filings. I think that, you know, the major issue was, like in all mergers, was cultural. And putting the two managements together, you know, was not an easy process, and some people didn't make it. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think it was a much stronger organization. The people from NSCC that joined their counterparts at DTC were, you know, really strong individuals, and I think were very important to the success of DTCC.
Yeah. Were most of those personnel issues that you talked about, were those made by the board? Or
No, it was at the management level, right?
Okay.
We had to deal with putting the two boards together. Kind of an interesting sidelight to that was when we put the two individual boards together, there were 37 individuals that were on both boards, and we wanted to get it down to. I think what we did is, we gave each participant who was represented on both boards the opportunity to choose one. So we got the number down to, I think, 27. And we were prepared to go forward with a board of 27. And I was informed by the Fed that there was a regulation that prohibited bank boards from being larger than 25. So we had to go to two of the board members and make them observers instead of full voting members. But ultimately, we had a participant election and resolved that problem.
That sorted that out.
I mean, Jill Considine, I've always said this about the chairman and CEO of DTC and DTCC. They were the right person at the right time, and I think Jill was the right person. She had a great way of dealing with the board. She came to DTC and then DTCC with a very strong reputation, particularly among New York bankers, coming where she came from, and she was just really masterful in dealing with the board, giving them what they needed, and was a terrific leader.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a number of programs to, you know, to deal with the different cultural issues among members of the senior staff, you know, some of which I, you know, may have been thought to be silly, but those are the kinds of things that, that companies do to try to put two organizations together. Mm-hmm. And I think at the end of the day, we had a very, very strong senior senior leadership.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did your role as a general counsel change after the merger? Did you just have sort of a broader portfolio of issues that you were working on, or was it more or less the same stuff?
Yeah, it was pretty much the same stuff. I mean, we had very good lawyers whom we inherited from NSCC, who continued to work on their stuff. Subsequently, and we may want to get into this, but subsequently we had an integration with the Government Securities Clearing Corporation, Mortgage-Backed Securities Clearing Corporation, and EMCC, which no longer exists. But those organizations also had very strong lawyers, so I didn't really need to get into their issues.
Okay. How closely did you work with the SEC during this period? I mean, were you in contact with them quite a bit?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think my whole career from the time I left the SEC, I think, you know, the focus, a major focus of what I did was dealing with the commission. You know, at the MSRB, we had to get our rules approved by the commission. We were inspected by the commission. Same at DTC and DTCC. So it was a lot of conversation with the commission staff, that partnership, I think, was very important to both organizations that I was general counsel of.
Did you, in general, throughout this period after you left the SEC, find that the SEC was, sympathetic, or was willing to listen to the concerns of the regulatees?
Well, certainly, I think my relationship with the commission staff, I think, was very good, and I think on their part, they were very responsive. I think I always thought it was important in dealing with the commission staff to be open and above board, to recognize that the commission staff probably their SOP was to be a little bit skeptical, which was a good thing. That's the way I was when I was on the commission staff. That they needed information, that they absolutely needed not to be surprised. It was important to, before making a proposal to this, or making a filing, to go in, talk to the commission staff about what it was we were attempting to do, try to answer their questions at that point, and then do our filing, and make sure that if we anticipated adverse comments in the comment period, to give the commission staff a heads up, so they would not be surprised by anything that we did. And I think in general, my relationship with the commission staff was good and was very productive.
What was that? Was that heads up? Was that usually a formal thing? They wanted a formal letter about it, or just, you know,
no,
a call saying, "Hey,
it was just a heads up."
You know,
maybe during the course of the initial meeting that I had with them, I said, you know, you may be getting some comments from so and so about this, and this is probably what they're going to say. That process became a little bit more formal as time went on, and although I would make them aware that there were adverse first comments coming in. When they got the comment, they would require me to respond to it in writing. So that was a little bit more formal as time went on. I was very fortunate, both at the MSRB and at DTC and DTCC, that I dealt with the same people over a long period of time. When I was at the MSRB, I dealt with the branch chief, was Jonathan Kalman, and I dealt with John during the time that I was there, and during a period of time when I was at DTC, and then he was replaced by Jerry Carpenter, and both of those people. Knew me, knew that they could trust what I was telling them, and they were very familiar with the organizations that I was representing. So it was a very fortunate circumstance for me.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular issues that came up during these early years after the merger that you'd like to comment on?
Just going back to the question you just asked, I would say that the one series of issues where I had the most difficulty, and this is entirely predictable, is issues involving competition. And I mentioned earlier the interface fees. That was obviously a very controversial issue, and the commission staff no doubt felt, you know, here's this big guy in New York in there. The effect of putting in these surcharges is going to cause those participants who are members of other depositories to close those accounts down and do all their business with DTC. We had the issues involving Thompson Financial.
Is this the plan for the global settlement system?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about how that played out?
Sure. At DTC, we had what was called the institutional delivery system, which essentially, and it was required back in 1983, the SROs essentially required DTC's ID system to be used by brokers who wanted to extend the delivery versus payment privilege to their customers. So that was typically institutions, and the way the ID system worked was their broker-dealers put in a confirmation, it was communicated to the investment advisor, and the investment advisor would have an opportunity to affirm or disaffirm the trade, and then once it was affirmed, it would automatically go to settlement at DTC. Thompson had a system that essentially compared trades in a different way, starting with a block trade, and then they had a system called Oasis. And the investment advisor would essentially allocate the block trade to its customers, and then the process would continue. In the mid 90s, DTC, in furtherance of going to T+3, wanted to put in a similar kind of system, and did a filing with the commission, which was opposed by Thompson Financial. And essentially, that was actually an enjoyable period of time for me, because I got to write lots of letters to the SEC basically saying, well, look, if Thompson Financial wants to compete with us, they should become a registered securities depository, just like we are. And then they would write back and so forth and so on. Eventually, of course, we, that is DTC and Thompson Financial, decided to get together and create what became Omgeo.
And that was somewhat unprecedented in the history of DTC, as I understand it, right? Cooperating with a private company and developing
absolutely. We had never done that. Mm-hmm. We had in the pursuit of integration, integrated with other clearing corporations, which became wholly owned subsidiaries of DTCC. We had never entered into an arrangement with a private company in which we own less than the entire interest. In this case, we ended up with I think 51% of the stock of Omgeo, and Thompson Financial ended up with 49%.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's see. I understand that you also had difficulty in dealing with commission at some point during this period after the merger in regards to specific rule filing. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was another issue where there was an allegation of involving competition. We had NSCC in this case had proposed a new process to deal with the communication between brokers that sponsored separately managed accounts and advisors. And it was very similar to the kind of communication setup that we'd always, that NSCC had had for a number of years for mutual funds. In any event, we did a filing with the commission, not expecting there to be any opposition. It was something that had been vetted with the SMA industry. It was something that they wanted. We did a filing, I think, in 2003. And lo and behold, a letter got sent to the commission by a senator from Georgia, who, although he was a Democrat, had made a speech at the Republican National Convention in, in 2004. He was somebody that the Republicans on the commission paid some attention to. In his letter, he said that the SEC's imprimatur on this SMA proposal, if they approved it, would be the death of a competitor who was a constituent of his in Georgia. That didn't turn out to be really true. Really, that competitor was not a competitor. They were in a somewhat different business, but in any event, we got hung up at the commission, first at the staff level, requesting additional information over an extended period of time before they would even present it to the commission. And I think we got delayed by about 2 years. Eventually, we got it to the commission. There was a vote, two Democrats in favor, two Republicans against. The fifth member, who was a Democrat, abstained, and we weren't able to get approval. P.S. 2008, DTCC was finally able to introduce this process through an unregulated subsidiary, DTCC. So
then you got it passed. No. So it goes. Yeah. All right. There's one final issue I want to ask you about that DTCC dealt with during this period, and that's the issue of naked short selling, which came up in the early 2000s and still pops up occasionally in the news. What is that, basically, naked short selling?
Well, the requirement of selling short is that you, when you do so, you are, you know that you're able to locate the securities that you've sold, and naked short selling is selling short without having any knowledge that you can acquire the securities that you've sold. And it was, you know, it was an allegation that was made by some companies whose stock price was going down, that this was the fault of short sellers. That may or may not have been the case. And somehow or other, NSCC got involved in this litigation. It was claimed that that NSCC's procedures, specifically the stock borrow program, which in fact had been filed with and approved by the commission many years before, was somehow involved. It was litigation, that we desperately wanted to avoid being in because of the complexity of trying to describe to a jury or a judge precisely what it was we do and what the stock borrower program was and what naked short selling was and why the former is irrelevant to the latter. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we were able to get dismissed out of, I think, all of the lawsuits that were filed. Mm-hmm.
All right. Did DTCC offer input into the, I guess, the drafts that eventually ended up being regulation SHO?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
Yeah, we did. And
DTCC was basically happy with that?
Very happy. Okay. Very happy to provide the information that was required.
Okay. So in 2008, you retired from DTCC.
Right.
And I guess since then, or perhaps even before, I'm not sure, you've been involved with the SEC Historical Society, which this interview is being done for, right?
Right.
Will you tell me about how you got involved with
that? Right. It was, I think it was actually back in maybe 2006 or 2007 that I got a call from Dick Rowe, who was involved with the society at that time. I don't think he was a trustee. but he was on the museum committee, who asked me if I would be interested in getting involved with the society as a member of their advisory council. And I said, sure. And so I was a member of the advisory council and ultimately got elected as a trustee in, I think, 2008, maybe. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years ago, I had been secretary and on a couple of committees. And a couple of years ago, I was asked if I wanted to stand for election as president. As I actually told the trustees in our last meeting, I was absolutely certain when I got that call that I had to have been the third or fourth person that was asked, and I really wanted to know why the others had turned it down. But anyway, I was assured no, I was the only candidate. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's true or not. In any event, I have served as president. I'm currently chairman. I'm going off the board after May of next year. And I am just, I've been thrilled to be involved with a society. I think all anybody has to do is just go online to www.sechistorical.org to see this wonderful virtual museum and archive that the society has developed. It's got so much interesting information about the history of securities regulation in this country, interviews with critically important people, some of whom unfortunately are no longer around. There's information, documents that are not available in this form anywhere else. And the museum is available. It's free of charge. It's open 24/7. And, you know, it's just a wonderful resource. You know, as time has gone on, I think we've finally gotten to over 1 million visitors to the museum, and it's only been around for 10 years. So I think it's been a very rewarding endeavor on my part, and I would certainly encourage anybody that listens to this interview, if you're not involved, to get involved, particularly if you were, as I was, a member of the staff of the commission. It's the story of our history as professionals.
Well, we appreciate all your hard work and also for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.